Hey, welcome back, everybody. Time once again for some Living Hope, a weekly journey designed to provide hope, inspiration, and education for those living with pancreatic cancer, sharing the real-life stories of those really affected by this deadly disease and how they deal with it on a daily basis. With a woman who's done it, well, for a day or two, I think. How many days? Do you ever count it by the days, Roberta, or is it just, you just round it off to the...
I just say the years now, but I did one time by the days, and I think I'll have to do that again because it sounds much more prominent.
It sounds impressive,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll have to do that
again.
For
when you were first diagnosed, we're what, 20?
I'm at 23 right now.
23?
Oh, yeah, I'll be 24 and 8 next month.
Look
in April.
Look at that, you're growing up here.
That's right. Well, I'm not sure about growing up.
So today, we're going to talk about a topic that we've explored before that always gets a big reaction because it's, I think, the first thing you asked when you were diagnosed and many others ask, Doc, get me in a clinical trial.
Actually, I didn't know about clinical trials, and it wasn't offered to me because they pretty much told me it was no use. But today we are joined by Megan Lyles, and she has spent 28 years working in the clinical research and clinical trials. And she's going to actually help us understand the better understanding of it, the challenges behind them, and the hope that we bring to future cancer treatments by using clinical trials. So thank you, Megan, for joining us. It's really great to see you and have you here. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you and learning more about clinical trials. So if you want to just give us a little bit of background about yourself, that would be great before we start.
Absolutely. And thank you again for inviting me to be on this podcast. This is something that is very near and dear to me in expanding access to clinical trials to all patients, because a lot of patients don't know about that there are options that exist for them in clinical trials. And unfortunately for oncology, as we'll talk about, sometimes you have to be conveniently located next to a large academic site in order to be able to access those trials. So a little bit about me. I started as a research coordinator in inner city Detroit, enrolling patients living with HIV and AIDS into NIH-sponsored trials. And so it's through that I really saw how wonderful of a thing clinical trials were for patients, because it gave them an opportunity to have, I don't think you ever want to say additional care, but it was. They just felt like they had someone else to talk to, and they had someone else who was watching after them, and it made them feel good to come into the clinic because they got to see and talk to someone else and share their concerns about what they were going through. So from that experience, I actually moved down to North Carolina. I got a little tired of those Detroit winters and have been here for the last 25 years and have worked more on the other side of clinical trials, and that's running the clinical trials for pharmaceutical companies. My focus has been across multiple therapeutic areas, infectious disease, respiratory, asthma. I've done a few pain studies, but really in the last 10 years, I focused in on oncology. And what a key area of focus for me was how to get clinical trials into more rural populations. I'm from a small town in Ohio, and I think about that a lot in terms of those people who I know and I grew up with, and them having to travel to Boston, to Columbus, to Cincinnati, just in order to access a trial. So again, this is something that is, it's very near and dear to me. And I thank you again for the opportunity to talk with everyone about clinical trials today.
Thank you, because I know a lot of times, like when I've asked somebody, like, what do you think? What is a clinical trial? What do you imagine it to be? And they say a lot of them feel like it's going to be like in a laboratory, a cold kind of setting. And so maybe you can help us understand what clinical trials really are and why they're so important in developing new treatments.
Yeah, so a lot of times that we hear things like, I don't want to be a guinea pig. And then they also, everybody hears about the animal studies and the testing on the monkeys and the dogs and the rabbits and those types of things. But really, just in its simplest form, a clinical trial is a research study that involves human participants. And we do these in order to test potential new treatments. It can be a new drug or a medical device. And we do this so that we can get new treatments approved for doctors to prescribe to patients to take. And so we have to test them before we have to make sure that they're safe for patients to take. That's the biggest thing for us, is we want to make sure that the patients are safe taking the medication. And then also we look to see if they're working, if they're effective. And then also sometimes these studies are just to see if there's a new treatment that is more effective than a current treatment, or maybe has fewer side effects than current existing treatments. So this is an important facet of drug development and getting new drugs out to people who need them. I'm sure that a lot of your listeners have experienced this, where you know they've gone through, and I know you have as well, you go through lines of treatment and then you exhaust the lines of treatment that are available for that specific cancer type. So it's important that we keep this going and keep drug development going so that we can help patients and help them live lives to their fullest.
You mentioned that one aspect. They always say, I don't want to be a guinea pig. So what, I mean, and none of us want to be experimented on, but you're not really a guinea pig. You're also getting maybe the new cancer, the new treatment. But mm-hmm. if not, you're at least getting what the standard treatment is for the current time, correct?
It depends on how the trial is set up. And really with this, I think there's sometimes these ideas of that we poke and we prod and we do everything else. But a lot of the procedures that we do during clinical trials are the same ones that are being done during regular doctor visits anyway, taking vital signs. We do like to take blood samples because we like to see how the drug is working in the patient's body. We do EKGs occasionally. We do a lot of imaging, physical exams, those types of things. So it's very standard, and it works into the regular clinical practice. So I think sometimes too, they do get this bad, like I said, everyone thinks I'm not going to be a guinea pig. You may be taking a drug that's taken with, as you mentioned, Roberta, it's taken with the medications you're already taking, or it may be taken with different medications. We monitor anyone who's on a clinical trial, we monitor them very carefully to make sure that everyone is staying safe. And actually, in those instances, we may ask you to come in a little bit more frequently, just again to make sure that we're doing everything right and that you're staying safe. That's the biggest priority for us with clinical trials. And I don't know necessarily if that's something that's said enough. We're always talking about the cures, and it, certainly everyone hears about the negative side effects of things, but really we want to make sure that patients are safe. That is such a huge component of everything that we do.
So what are some things patients and families might not realize about how complex these trials actually are?
So probably the biggest thing that I hear about is that just anyone talking about clinical trials, they're really surprised at how much goes into getting new drugs approved. And everyone always hears it costs $100 million or something like that to get a new drug approved and those types of things. But we have to do several different types of studies in order to get the drugs approved. And so as the pharmaceutical companies that are developing these new products, they are working closely with FDA to make sure that their studies are well designed and that FDA agrees with the data that need to be collected, that there are a certain number of patients. So we have to have statisticians involved to make sure that the studies are powered appropriately. We have physicians, scientists, we have everybody involved in designing these studies. And so there's really a team effort in all of that. And one of the biggest components of this, and this is something that has really come to light in the last few years, is that several regulatory agencies, such as FDA, and over in Europe, there's MHRA and other heads of the countries for drug development, they are mandating that we get patient feedback on protocol designs, because that is an important component of it, that we understand from the patient perspective what's important to them and is the study doable from their perspective. So we're really taking a wider pool of feedback to make sure that the study is working for what the sponsor needs, what the pharmaceutical company needs in order to get the drug approved, and then also for the patient, and then also for the provider as well. So there is a lot that goes into these. And then also just thinking about what procedures we need to do. Every study is set up with a basic study with a hypothesis and what data we're going to collect, how we're going to collect it, and what are we? How are we going to analyze that data when we collect it? Typically for clinical trials, we start with phase one trials. Those are the ones that we first start trying the drug in a patient population, and then they can go all the way up to phase three or even phase four. And we have different studies along the way where we're making sure that we're getting this in the right population of patients, that where we're seeing that the drug is working.
How long offhand does it take generally to get a drug approved?
It's a trick question. It's a tough question. For oncology, there are accelerated pathways, and for rare diseases, there can also be accelerated pathways to get drugs approved, meaning that the pharmaceutical company can talk with FDA and they can agree upon what's needed in order for them to get the drug for FDA to review the data and tell them whether or not the drug is approved. And then they can follow up with additional studies once the drug is approved. So there are some accelerated means of doing that, but typically from the time that the drug is developed in the laboratory to the time that they get approval, anywhere between 7-10 years, probably. It really takes a long time. And one of the things that does impact that is just our ability to find patients who want to participate in clinical trials and who want to be part of that clinical trial. And that does take us some time in order to recruit those studies. So that's been a key focus area, is trying to, and this is why this is so important, is that we're trying to figure out how we can get more patients involved in clinical trials. Because right now, as I mentioned earlier, unless you're conveniently located within an hour's distance of a major academic site, most likely you're not going to be on a clinical trial just because of lack of, not aware of what's available near you, and then the driving time and the transportation time to get to the site for the visits.
So most of the clinical trials take place at the larger medical facilities, correct?
They do, and it's largely because that's where we work with physicians who are key opinion leaders in specific therapeutic areas, and also the larger institutions, they have the staff, they have the facility, they have the infrastructure that's needed in order to do these, especially these early phase studies, which require a lot of close monitoring. And one of the things, though, that I have seen is that these large academic sites are making better use of satellite sites that are within the same, still within the same medical system, but they're at locations that are more convenient to patients. A couple of years ago, we did, when I was with another company, we were talking with the team at, I believe it was Roswell Park, and they were saying how one of the biggest feedback that they got from their patients was the cost of parking at their main facility. And so they started looking at how they could shift some of the clinical trial visits to one of their sites that was more conveniently located in a suburb that had free parking. Parking was very accessible. It was right next to the medical building. And just to be able to help patients out with that.
Yeah, because as a patient, especially when you're doing treatment, whether it's regular treatment or a clinical trial, you don't always feel like traveling. It's really difficult sometimes just to do the car ride. So if we could get more satellite hospitals to get involved, and what would it take to get them more involved or to have these satellite setups for patients?
So from our perspective, what we do is we ask the sites if they're going to be using other facilities, and we're working with a group of sites down in Texas right now on one of our ongoing trials, and they have centers across the state of Texas, and they're able to see patients for study visits at those sites. And so because of that, it's the patient may have to travel to the main site for maybe the screening visit or maybe the initial visit where they're getting the drug. But then after that, they can be seen at the other sites that are more convenient to them. So there is a lot of movement to make it more convenient for the patients, understanding that a lot of the, even the large academic sites, they're recruiting patients from all over. MD Anderson is notorious for this. They recruit patients from Alabama, Florida. We had one who was recruited from Iowa. And so they're making those accommodations to be able to have the patient come down for key visits, but then also follow up with their local oncologist as well and being able to collect the data from that. So there's a lot of good, there's a lot of good things happening right now in terms of expanding that access. And one of the other key, another key focus area the last few years, and this has been through ASCO, which is the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and then also even NIH, is community programs in oncology. And NIH started this community program where they have base centers that are, and then they have a network of community sites that, so the base centers is where those patients are primarily seen, and then they can be seen by their community sites or the community oncologists. So again, this is an area where everyone is taking it very seriously and looking at how we can expand access.
So maybe patients. Where there isn't maybe a satellite, are there other efforts being made to reduce the burden, allowing home visits or test follow-ups to happen closer to home, like maybe you said, like maybe at their oncologist? Or
yeah, there are. The one thing that gets a little tricky for oncology is just by virtue of the type of therapeutics that are administered to patients. Typically, chemotherapeutics, those have to be administered within a clinic. And then even some of the newer drugs that impact the immune system, there is a preference for those to be administered in a clinic under physician's care just because of potential side effects with those drugs. But in terms of follow-up visits where drug is not administered, yes, absolutely. There are several organizations that can do home visits. We're also, a number of protocols that I'm working on now allow telemedicine visits for follow-up visits, and then they can go to a local, they can go somewhere local for blood draws, those types of things. So there are more and more accommodations being made to protocols, and sponsors are making sure because that they put those in there because they want to make sure that every piece of data that we collect is extremely important, and it's difficult to replace that if we're not getting those data. And so it's important for us that patients are staying on the study as long as they possibly can, because that's what needs to go into the packages that go to FDA so that we can get the drugs approved.
So despite all these challenges, what are some positive developments that you're seeing in the field right now?
So again, the really positive thing that I've seen is a couple of years ago, I was working at a different company, and I was focused on what was called operational strategy, and it was how to operationalize these studies. And what I'm seeing more and more is these that sponsors are taking very seriously that they need to figure out how to make their protocols flexible so that patients can be seen at other locations other than the main site. They're also using more of providing reimbursement for transportation, which is also good. Again, the parking fees, making sure that it's more readily available. Previously, it was that the patient had to submit a receipt, and then the receipt had to be go through the administration at the hospital, and then it was passed on to the sponsor, and then maybe probably 2 months later the patient gets a check for their parking fee. And so there's a lot more use of providing debit cards to patients that they can use that have that money already loaded on it so that they can use it for that, for the parking fees at that point in time, because it adds up so quickly. And even close by to where I am at, Duke University is close by to me. And I think even a couple of years ago, the parking was maybe $20 or $25 a day or something like that over at the medical center, which I'm sure has gone up since that time. Addressing those types of issues, and then also the sites realizing that they can do more by expanding the access to their satellite centers and using those satellite centers for data collection. So there's a lot of good positive movement going forward with that. And then also the realization that we are, I hate to say failing people, but clinicaltrials.gov is definitely not the most user-friendly interface.
I agree.
Even with their recent redo, which I somehow found their recent redo to make it even worse. But there's a lot of companies who are invested in doing and pulling information from clinicaltrials.gov and putting it into a more user-friendly interface to be able to find clinical trials more easily and more readily, because that is something that has been difficult, is navigating through clinicaltrials.gov and trying to find a study that you're potentially eligible to participate in. Again, there's a lot of good forward movement there. In terms of pancreatic cancer itself, there is a lot of working in the early phase space, which is what I do. So I work on trials that are basically proof of concept. They want to see if the drug works, or first in human, which means it's the first time that we're putting it into an actual person. And talking to these developers, there is a lot of interest in developing compounds for pancreatic cancer, which is also really exciting to see, because that has been such an area of need for the past several years. So there's a lot of good positive things that are happening. There's been a lot of, I'm sure everyone is aware of some of the struggles and challenges as an industry we have seen with money being taken away from with NIH through NIH funding, but somehow developers are finding a way, because for drug developers, they do this because it's personal. They do it because they have someone who is impacted by a disease and they see that they can do something about it. And it gives me a lot of hope and a lot of optimism in terms of that there's still such good people out there doing good things, and because they want people to be cured. So despite everything else that you may hear about clinical trials and in the news and everything else, there's still a lot of excitement and a lot of positivity about being able to basically cure cancer.
Okay, I think Paul has a question for you.
I've stayed quiet during this fascinating conversation here, but I got to butt in and ask a question. I heard, not on this show, but another medical show that we do here on OC Talk Radio, a guy that does clinical trials for Alzheimer's. And mm-hmm. he said a point that I never thought of. It is hard, or I'll ask you, maybe I'll ask it as a question. Is it hard to get a broad selection of the public? Meaning, does everybody show up the same? They look like me. They're old white people or something. Is it hard to get African-Americans and Hispanics and Asians? He said it was hard to recruit them, not just because of language, but because of hesitation to listen to doctors. And how do you find them? How do you communicate them? And maybe they have more trouble getting there, or they feel uncomfortable. Talk about that. Because he said if you're trying to do a clinical trial and you're just getting a very narrow group of people, everybody gets cancer. So why are we just looking at one small subset? And is that the case?
It is absolutely the case, and it's one of those sad state of things that the majority of drugs that have been approved based off of primarily white males. And I think there wasn't, at the time that this was all done, there's only been the recognition in the past several years that we all process and metabolize drugs differently from a gender perspective as well as race perspective as well. And so you start seeing things that maybe in women, you start seeing a certain side effect that it was fine in men, but women have different metabolic pathways. So it is absolutely a problem to get a wide diversity. And there was a lot of initiatives that I had to write a diversity plan when I worked at a small pharmaceutical company that was addressing, because this was for chronic kidney disease, and we had to address how we were going to recruit the target patient population, which was primarily Black men and women. And so how do we do this knowing that there have been a lot of things throughout the years that have impacted their trust in the clinical research. So it is something that we do look at and we struggle with, and we try to make sure that we are being equitable in terms of getting those patients in and understanding their perspective. And I think that's the key thing, is understanding their perspective of why they have these hesitancies and why they may not be wanting to participate in clinical trials. Yeah, it is something that I don't have an answer for you, other than it is something that we struggle with.
I know we're also, the whole idea of diversity is now a bad word or something, but if you want to get a pop, if you're trying to serve the whole population, everybody's got pancreatic cancer, then you want to get as diverse a babe, old, young, different ethnic groups, different religion, different races, all that stuff here. Because otherwise the drug isn't, may not work like you think it was for everybody.
Exactly. Exactly. And right now, one of the things that I'm working on that I'm very excited about is I have the opportunity to work on cell therapy trials, which is taking the patient's own cells and doing some manipulation of them and then infusing them back into the patient to be able to attack the tumors. And
another hot topic we've talked, wasn't that another, what Hoag is doing
yes.
here?
Yeah, so that's another thing in another thing entirely about that, but I don't have a good answer for that. And it's unfortunate, even looking at the demographics of the studies that we're doing now, they're largely male.
Yeah, they're guys that look like me, old white guys here. Right, yeah, exactly.
We have a few younger ones.
We're talking about how fast time goes when we're talking, and there's still more we want to talk about. But before I let you go, for patients who may feel intimidated by the idea of a clinical trial, what would you want them to understand the most?
That we're here to protect them. And I think that just goes unnoticed because you hear all the time about the negative things that come out of clinical trials, but there's really positive things that come out of clinical trials too. And we are very careful and we monitor the patients very, very carefully throughout the study, probably to the point that the patients get annoyed with all the questions they're asked because we're constantly asking them, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel?
But how do you feel about how do you feel?
Exactly. And it's, we want to make sure that we're doing right by the patient. And we have a lot of regulations that go behind our industry. We're highly regulated. For those who are intimidated by clinical trials, I would encourage them to reach out to advocacy groups. And there's a lot of the advocacy groups that help find clinical trials and that can answer questions about clinical trials. And also, I would encourage, and I know this is a big ask, but ask the questions, ask anything of what's involved with this and what do I need to do and how much time commitment will there be for me to do this. So it's important that to ask questions, and no question is silly whatsoever when it comes to participating in a clinical trial. So it is a lot. It's a lot to think about. We've also heard this thing where physicians won't inform their patients of clinical trials, and then the patient is expecting the doctor to tell them about the clinical trial. And I would encourage everyone to reach out to, like I said, advocacy groups are really good about being able to help talk through what's involved and then even help find clinical trials that may work for them.
Yeah, and we'll list a couple of those because we do have a few that are really great clinical trials. One is pancan.org and letswinpc.org. But we'll put that in the group somewhere. But Megan, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your knowledge and insights. And there's still so much to discuss, and we're continuing this conversation. Welcome you back on Thursday, March 26th. So we'll see you back again, and we'll finish up some things. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
As long as you speak my name, I shall live forever is dedicated to Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Throughout her life, she dedicated herself to serving others and giving a voice to those who needed it most. Her legacy of leadership, courage, and compassion will continue to inspire generations to come. Sheila passed 6 weeks after her diagnosis at the age of 74. So today is Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Thank you.
There you go. Some real life information that you may want to know on this journey we call Living Hope. A weekly journey designed to provide hope, inspiration, and education for those living with pancreatic cancer. Sharing the real life stories of those really affected and how they deal with it. And things like clinical trials and all sorts of other questions that are on everybody's minds. If you'd like to learn more, we invite you to share this with others and come back and share it every week with us. And if you'd like to know more about any of the topics talked about here today or find out how you can get help, lots of organizations. Let's tout one of them here today, letswinpc.org. Check it out and go find out more as we continue this journey together right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Applied Innovation Center.